Welcome to 3GT, the podcast for three guys, a pastor, a professor, and a parishioner discuss theology from a practical standpoint, all from a Reformed perspective. Find out more at 3GT.xyz.
Welcome back to 3GT Land. We are glad that you have joined us today. Hopefully you've missed us. Hopefully you're glad that another episode of Three Guys Theologizing is back on the air. And we hope this particular conversation today will be a blessing to you. This is one of your co-hosts on 3GT, Barry York. And today I'm joined with another one of my co-hosts, Scott Hunt. And Scott, it's good to see you again.
It's always good to see you, Barry. It's been a long time. I'm glad we can do this again.
Yes, me as well. Kyle Borg is not with us, and he's still attending to certain projects that he's been involved with, and it'll be a while before he joins us back. But we want to continue to record, and Scott, now that Kyle's not here, maybe there's some things you just want to say and you get know, off your chest.
I miss Kyle. I miss getting brought down a peg or two by him. Kyle, I hope you listen to this episode. I really do miss you. It's not quite the same without you.
Yeah, we miss him, and we'll look forward to his return in the future. But we're still going to continue to record once again episodes of 3GT, and we have things lined up, some interviews that are coming, some topics that we're interested in discussing with one another, and we'll probably even have some other pastors. Maybe we can just try out some other co-hosts during this time, Scott, just to see.
We're not saying it's an audition, but it could be an audition.
Well, that's right.
I'm joking, Kyle.
Well, it wasn't only Kyle that had projects. I certainly had a busy period of time that I've just come through with projects I was working on. But I know, Scott, you had a certain burden that you were facing during this time where we haven't been recording. And that's actually the subject of our episode today, is because just this past month or so, Scott has finished up a murder trial that took place in his county, Grant County there in Indiana. And now that the trial is over and it's in the news, we felt that there was some freedom here for us to talk about that. What Scott right. does as a job is a difficult one, and he carries a lot of burdens in that. And so I think part of Scott, you just thinking through things, I think it would be great for our audience to hear what you go through. We're going to talk about a particular trial, but these are the types of things that you face in your job as a prosecuting attorney. So why don't you just...
I would begin by saying this, Barry. And until I started this particular job, I don't think any of us appreciate the grace that God shows us in protecting us from what actually goes on in society. Mm. Most of us we drive down the street and we don't give much thought about what's happening in houses, what people's lives are about. Ooh. We get upset when somebody cuts us off on the road. I say this because this is where God's put me and I can handle it, but there are just terrible things that happen, and people's lives apart from Christ, they are just horrid. And to walk in some of these houses, see pictures of some of these houses, to know how some children live, some adults live, you would be flabbergasted. And I don't think probably most of our listeners cannot appreciate just how blessed they are and just how messed up our society is. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get that off my chest.
Yes. Well, it's different hearing it in the news than experiencing it personally or dealing up close with it. Of course, in our ministry together in Indiana, with some of the situations that we had to face, we did see some of the messy lives of people, but I know what you faced here in this particular trial is of a great evil.
And yeah, so. And it's possibly one of the, I'll say it's one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. And so I guess just to give give you listeners kind of an idea of what's going on. When I give a closing statement in a court case, I don't memorize it. It usually takes about 40 minutes. And I don't memorize it. It's not spontaneous. I would, but generally the first paragraph or two of the main points, I want to get that down. So I think it might be good to just kind of give you an idea, an overview of what happened. So if you don't mind, Barry, I can just share this and then we can kind of go from there. We can talk and ask questions. All this is public, by the way. This was live streamed. I actually, middle of the trial, not during the trial, but in the midst of it, Kyle watched it and he made sure to give me a little bit of a ribbing. So I do appreciate that. But Kyle watched part of it. So none of this is secret. It's all been in the open. It's all been reported on the news.
Nonetheless, just so everyone's aware, because we may have some sensitive listeners, this deals with the death of a child. So
yes,
if this is just something you don't want to give time to, we would certainly understand if you don't want to listen to this episode.
Or maybe, you know, skip the next 5 minutes. And then I think we can probably get on the other side of some of the more heart-wrenching things and just talk about the process and what it was like. It was, I think, August. I can't remember. It's been about a month now, just over a month. That we wrap this up. But here's how I began my closing argument. I had to stop myself in front of the jury because I choked up. I almost cried and still may. On August 31st, 2019, at a little after 3:30 p.m., Kevin Carmack said goodbye to his daughter, Skyly Carmack. He could not have known that when he was saying goodbye, this would be the last time he would ever see Skyly's face or hear her voice. He had no clue of the atrocity that was going to take place within the next few hours. You have heard this incident described as a tragedy. This was not a tragedy. A tragedy is when a deer runs in front of a vanload of children, causing it to crash. A tragedy is when a tornado hits a school, killing children inside. An atrocity is a 34-year-old woman putting her hands around the neck of a 10-year-old girl to try to squeeze the life out of that child. And when that is not working, she grabs a pair of leggings and ties a knot around her neck so tight that the doctor cannot even get his finger between the leggings and the girl's neck to cut it off. That is an atrocity. Kevin did not hear from Amanda again until 8:59 p.m. when Amanda sent that text message. I think we have a problem. Remember everything Amanda said, everything Amanda did, everything Amanda allowed to happen from that time, from the time that text message was sent, was done with the full knowledge that 10-year-old Skyly Carmack was dead. And I'm going to skip over, dead, shoved into a trash bag with her blanket, her pillow, and her backpack filled with all the specific items Amanda described. Amanda described with chilling accuracy so many details that no one could ever have known, and she did so with a calmness that belied the horrendous event that led to more than 3 days of frantic searching by Kevin, by her friends, and by her community. That, in a nutshell, is what happened. As hard as it is to say those words and to hear those words, it's even harder to see the story of those words. This happened not in Marion, where I live. This happened in a small town of about, I would say, 3,000 in Gas City, Indiana. So it's not like it happened in some big city that's apart from all of us. I mean, this happened in small town America. Mm-hmm. It made statewide news, especially as I alluded to, everybody was out looking for Skyly. Her name was Skyly Carmack. She was 10 years old. And you know, for 3 days, the community was searching for this little girl, and
because the stepmother said that she had gone missing.
Yeah. So when the stepmother called 911, about 10 minutes after she sent a text to her husband, she didn't, she reported her daughter as, well, I'm not sure if I want to report her as a runaway or as a missing child. I just know she's not in the house. So that began the process of getting state police involved. I would say there were probably 10 or 11 different agencies from around the county and state involved in the search for this girl. And all the while she was there on the property I described. And, it's fascinating what little things you pick up in an investigation. But what broke this, what really helped this, were video cameras at a factory that was nearby. And the detectives who did a marvelous job in this case got this, and you could tell that the girl never left the house. And so they were able to confront Amanda with the fact that, look, we know she never left the house and we are going to find her. So that ultimately led to the confession and the body being discovered.
Mm. So she finally broke under the pressure and
kind of, not unlike most criminals, they will tell you just enough, to get off their back. So it was not much. It was a pseudo confession. She said, "Oh, it's like a dream. I can see myself. I can see myself on top of her doing, and putting my hands around her neck. I see her face." So that's kind of, and I think she, and she described the location where she was. So it wasn't really a confession. It wasn't, "I'm sorry." It was just enough to tell the police where it was to get it over with. If that makes any sense. As a kid, I used to do the same thing. "Sorry, Mom and Dad," where I would, if I did something wrong and they knew it, I would confess to just enough to get a little bit of trouble, but I wouldn't tell them the full story. So I wouldn't get in a ton of trouble. I have confessed to that sin to my parents, since then, by the way.
Yes. I think we can all relate to that aspect of it. So this crime took place how long ago, Scott?
It happened in August of 2019. So it was 2 years ago. It took 2 years for this to be brought to trial.
And you told me that she was found guilty.
She was found guilty. Actually, today, the day that we're recording this, she was sentenced, and she was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole, which in Indiana means she will never get out of prison. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to get into the private details and discussions. The death penalty probably would have been warranted, in my opinion. I mean, and to be quite honest, in most murder cases, it's warranted. But even by statute, it probably could have been warranted in this case. And in my opinion was, there are reasons that it was not sought. We got what we wanted. And short of the death penalty, there was nothing more severe we could have done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know it's always hard to get into the mind of someone who's gotten to this state of being able to commit such an atrocity, as you called it, but was there any evidence of what motivated this ultimately? Was it jealousy, anger at the child? I mean,
it was anger at the child. The argument at trial was that this was not murder. It was voluntary manslaughter. And without boring our listeners with technical legal jargon, voluntary manslaughter is when you are triggered, that would cause an ordinary person to react in the way that you did. But it has to be more than words. You can't just go in and say, "I hate you." And, if you get killed for that, that's not voluntary manslaughter. I described it like this to the jury because we had to discuss this. I said, sudden heat to trigger manslaughter is like walking in. If you have a gun, you walk into your house and you find your spouse with somebody else and you pull the trigger. That's voluntary manslaughter. Mm-hmm. In this case, a little background about the family that came out, and I'm not going to, other than the victim's name, I'm not going to give any other names, but there were, the victim was the daughter of the of Kevin, but not the defendant. So this it was stepmom who was the defendant. There were six other kids who lived in the house. Five full-time lived in the house. One was there half the time. And so one can only speculate as to motive. We don't have to prove motive. But I think there was the fact that it wasn't her child played a big part in it. She was, you know, to she was the girl was not an, a perfect angel by any stretch of the imagination. What happened that day was she had taken a charm bracelet from one of her step siblings and given different pieces out to her other siblings. That was found out by the defendant at about, I want to say about 1:30 in the afternoon. At 3:30, her dad, who was an over the road truck driver and was actually in Maryland, they had a video chat, which is when he saw his daughter the last time. That was at about, that was at 3:30. We know that for sure. So there's 2 hours at least that she's had to calm down from her, from the child doing this. And it was, and it wasn't malicious. It wasn't a malicious act. Like I hate the child that this was given to. It was kind of just a silly thing that kids do sometimes. I would say, but Amanda, the defendant, she, just don't think she ever let it go. It had been building with her. So that's kind of that, that's the motive, but it comes from, and I would, I have no problems. It comes from an, a place of evil in the heart. There was really, I would say, and we argued, no remorse on the part of the defendant in this. I shared briefly before we began that very seldom do I get angry in the courtroom or worked up or raise my voice, but I confess in this trial there was a phase where I had to cross-examine the defendant, and I kind of lost it. I didn't lose it. I got really, really, really upset and let her know. To the point where most of the people who know me in the courthouse were kind of saying, "Man, I've never seen you like that before."
Well,
which is good. I don't know for that, but it was very emotional, very. And I don't know that it takes an emotional toll, not just on me, obviously, but on the jury. On the detectives. We had a great opportunity to speak to the jury afterward, after it was all said and done. I've never had this happen. I always make myself available to the jury to ask questions. You know, what can I do better? What did I do okay? But there were 12 jurors plus two alternates, and I was sitting outside waiting for them. And the judge actually sent his bailiff out and said, "Hey, the jury would love to talk to you if you want to come in." So I actually got to sit in the jury room and,
and this is after the trial, sir.
This is after the trial. Yeah. After the trial, after the verdict, after everything was done. So that was really interesting. And I felt really bad to put 14 people through this, this horrendous, because what you can't see and what I'm not going to describe is, you know, we have to prove a lot of things, and we had to see a lot of things that I never, ever, ever want to see again. And unfortunately, the jurors had to see that or see some of it. They didn't have to see everything that, that we had to see, but it just takes a tremendous strain on, it puts a tremendous strain on the jury and on us. And, you know, for this trial lasted, it was 6 days. So
I was going to ask how long it was.
It started on Monday morning, August 3rd. It went all the way through Friday. We, that was the first phase. And when I say it went, you know, it was like 8:30 or 8 in the morning. It started at about 8:30, but I have to get there and get ready. And the other attorneys, other prosecutors that helped, we have to get there. And it would last from about 8:30 until 4:30 or 5 at night, every night. And what I don't know that, it's hard to explain, But as a pastor, are you tired after preaching a sermon?
Sure.
Yes. And not physically tired, just mentally drained, right? I mean, sometimes mm-hmm. that's so because you have to be on that entire time. Well, that whole week, we have to be on because we're scheduling witnesses. We have to listen to the testimony. We have to make objections. We have to plan. We have to make sure that we're doing everything. So it's a stressful time. So at the end of the 5 days before the guilty verdict was rendered, I was tired and I feel bad for my wife. She is a saint, by the way, if I've never mentioned that, but she was supporting me and I never talked much about what was going on. She knew basically what the audience knows now, but she obviously could tell it's affecting me emotionally and mentally. And after I gave my closing argument on Friday, that happened, I would say at about 12:30 on Friday afternoon is when I finished with the closing. And then the jury gets it and they get to deliberate. I came home right after that and I just bawled I took my lunch hour and just, I didn't cry the entire time, but it was just emotionally draining to go through this. So,
you won, but you don't rejoice in that victory because others have lost so much.
I've been asked in several other cases where, newspaper calls me up. I actually declined an interview for this case this afternoon. After I walked out of the courthouse, there was a news lady there who recognized me from the trial. She said, "Hey," and I walked over and she introduced herself. I said, "Oh, I know who you are. I've seen you in the news." And she said, "Would you like to say anything?" "No, not really. I don't want to." But I've been asked, "Are you happy with the verdict?" And that's a really tricky question.
Yeah, yeah.
I am satisfied with the verdict. I'm never happy with a verdict. I would be much happier if this never happened. And that's what I've said in other cases. I'm not happy. What we have here is a man who lost his daughter, a mom who lost her daughter, siblings who have lost their stepsister, their sister. We have kids that have lost their mom because she's never getting out of prison. We have 14 citizens who have had to live this nightmare and make a decision and see and hear things that I haven't shared. There's no winner in this. There's no reason to rejoice or be happy about the verdict. That being said, I take great satisfaction that justice was done. I take great satisfaction to know that Kevin, though he'll never have his daughter again, knows that the person who is responsible for her death, her murder, has faced justice. There's a lot to be thankful about in this verdict, but there's no happiness in this verdict.
Right. Scott, so our listeners know that this was in the news, and I actually saw a news clip of a reporter covering the case, and she mentioned your name several times.
Yes.
And there was one part where the whole concept of a good person came up, and I thought it was interesting to hear her recount how you were using this whole concept of what a good person is in the courtroom. And so could you just recount that for our listeners? Cause I found that fascinating.
Sure. It was one of the I don't want to say funner. You have to understand. Sometimes I have to build up a wall or just, I deal with things in a different way, but
expose wickedness and show its irony, show its foolishness and that type of thing. And I think that's what you did what I gathered.
But it did irritate me and kind of got under my skin a little bit. Just a little background as well. So in this trial, there were two phases or two parts of the trial. The first was the murder. And we had to get a guilty conviction on the murder first. And we did. Mm-hmm. And then there was a second phase where we had to argue about whether life imprisonment without the possibility of parole was appropriate, or if she should just get, they call it a term of years, you know, a set sentence. You'll be spending 65 years in prison. You'll do 75% of it. So that's what the argument was about.
Mm-hmm.
There were three witnesses, and thankfully I don't remember their names, that came and testified on her behalf. And each of the witnesses was asked by her attorney, would you say Amanda is a good person? And without, yeah, obviously that's what they're going to say. That's what they're there for. They're her friends or her family.
So these are like character witnesses.
Yeah, these are character
witnesses. They didn't witness the murder. They just are testifying on behalf of the defendant.
Right. And so I, part of my cross-examination of these witnesses, I clearly wanted to address, well, what's a good person? And so, you know, when they're answering the initial questions of why she's a good person, oh, well, she came and helped and she did this and she did that. And, you know, she helped us move when I needed stuff, or she was always there for us. She's a good person. So I get up, like any good reformed person would do. What is a good person? You know? So I asked them again to define what a good person is. And, she's done good works, so she's a good person.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ask, does a good person strangle a 10-year-old girl? Mm. Does a good person do this? And you know, what strikes me, to the core is the people answered, well, no, well, she's a good person. She just did something bad. So, I mean, the way that people are willing to contradict themselves and seem to have no problem with it, I really push that. No, she's not a good person. And truth be told, none of us are.
Right.
But
Romans 3 testifies to that.
Right. I mean, there's, you know, none of us are good. But it was, I pushed the idea that, you know, just because you have done good things in the past does not make you a good person.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I hope the jury agreed. I mean, she got what we were asking, but, that's kind of the tact I was taking with them. And, you know, I was probably a little bit more graphic in my questioning.
Well, according to the reporter, you were. she was talking about this. We'll put this in the show notes if people want to watch the news clip about it.
It's very interesting. The reporting was really, really good. She did a good job. There were a few things, the way that she described things are not how I would have described them. There was a time and when I was cross-examining the defendant that the reporter describes me as getting frustrated. And I don't think frustrated is the right word. It was angry. the issue was, you know, she's been no criminal conduct in the past. It came out on the witness stand that she smokes pot every day or nearly every day. And so
that's what good persons do.
Well, yes, she's self-medicating, right? So I asked her, I said, you know, I think I may have asked something like, you know, you say you don't have any criminal history, is that right? Yeah. You said you smoke pot every day, right? Yeah. Pot's illegal. You know, marijuana is illegal. Well, not in every state. Well, it's illegal in Indiana, isn't it? Well, some people don't think it should be.
Yeah.
So it was that... You could see the darkness of her heart and justifying her actions, as opposed to, it would have been much better for her to say, yeah, you know what? It was wrong for me to do that. I shouldn't have, but you know, that just wasn't her demeanor. So anyway, if you read the news article, take some of the descriptions of how I was feeling at the time with a grain of salt.
Well, we will give you that grace.
I appreciate that.
How long did it take the jury to deliberate?
There were two different deliberations. So,
oh yes,
the initial deliberation took about 3 hours.
For the guilty verdict.
For the guilty verdict. And so she wasn't just charged with murder. There were, it was murder, neglect of a dependent resulting in death, domestic battery resulting in death, and strangulation. So they had to go through each one of those charges, not just murder. And then they had to debate whether or not it was provoked by this 10-year-old girl or not. So 3 hours really was not a surprise. Usually verdicts take about 2 hours. In most cases, murder cases, I would say take 3, 4, sometimes 5 hours. So 3 hours was relatively quick. So I was kind of pleased about that. Mm-hmm. The life without parole was probably, I want to say, about an hour and a half deliberation.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, that's quite the story and quite yes. the experience the Lord's taken you through. I thought we'd just conclude here with a question or two about the idea of justice.
Yes.
You know, we're those who speak about Micah 6:8, what the Lord requires of us is to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. And it seems like in the church today, even there can be almost an aversion to justice in some quarters, where we want to tolerate and be nice, and we would think that someone having to spend life behind bars for the rest of their lives is it's just not fair to the person, those kinds of arguments. There's others who would almost, you know, again, be glee over someone getting their just the desserts. And you've kind of spoken to that a little bit, but just how do you keep that balance in mind, Scott, between the ideas of justice and mercy? We're to do justice, but we're to love mercy. How in the Christian's mind, especially when you're facing something of this nature, how do you think through that?
First of all, people like to put them in opposition to each other, as if there is a difference between right. doing justice and loving mercy. And the reality is, they are not juxtaposed like that. They are two sides of the same coin. And so I look at it that way. It's easier for me to describe in a case where it's not quite as heinous. I do as you're. The audience listeners, I think you're aware that I do a lot of domestic violence cases where, you know, there's typically a male battering a female. So to do justice is to make sure that that man gets the sentence he deserves. In this murder trial, you know, that she be held responsible. To do mercy in most people's eyes is to cut the guy a break or to cut her a break, to show her slack. To me, if I were to show that kind of mercy in a case like that, like this murder case, it would be at the expense of justice for the victim or for the victim's mm-hmm. family. The mercy that is shown in my practice is not necessarily to the defendant. The mercy that is shown is to the victim or to the victim's family in this case. It is without mercy to not do justice in a case like this. And so I don't have some people think you get it from both angles, right? I get it from both sides. How are you being just when you do this or you offer a plea? Because a lot of these things in plea agreements and we haven't really talked about is 2 weeks after this trial, I had a pretty nasty trial ready to go. It was not a murder trial. It was a rape trial. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot more than just that. It's probably not what you would most people would think of rape. But I don't want to get into that. But the fact is I pled the guy guilty and he probably didn't get as much time as most people would want. He's getting significant amount of jail time. But the reason I did that is because I talked to the victim and I knew that she was in a place to where she could not handle having to go to trial and facing this man. Because I asked her, I said, I'm happy to do it. I'm willing to do it. She did not want to. And so it would have, if I didn't take that into consideration, if all I wanted was my pound of flesh from this guy, I would not be showing mercy to her. Mm-hmm. And so justice to her was showing her mercy by giving, you know, the guy pled guilty to quite a bit, and is going to be doing a significant portion of time in prison. But she was happy because she didn't have to be victimized again, which is kind of a hard concept for people to get. You know, a victim, let's talk about, you know, in a case where somebody has been abused by their husband, you know, the domestic battery, the victim in that case will be victimized at least three times. The first time when it happens, when the incident happens, then they go to deposition and they have to sit there across from the person who did this from them and answer questions from a defense attorney. And then a third time they have to relive it at trial. So that is, for some people, that is so painful they can't do it or don't want to do it. And so I try to show mercy when I can to victims in cases like that. But it, not at the expense of justice either. I mean, you can't just, I'm going to dismiss the case because it's too hard on you to go to trial. No, we can't do that. But there has to be a balance. And that's how I try to play that coin.
Mm. Well, Scott, I really appreciate you opening up about this and not only just explaining the case, but some of the heart struggles you go through you seek to bring that justice to bear in these types of situations, as well as show the mercy. And of course, as Christians, all this makes sense when we look at the cross, because there we see the justice of God coming down on his own son on our behalf so that he can extend the mercy of the Lord to us. So they're not opposed to one another. They work in tandem under the Lord. So thank you, my friend, for what you are doing and your part and your work for the kingdom of God and bringing justice to this world, even in the midst of a lot of brokenness and sad situations. Yeah. Well, we're thankful that you've come back and joined us for 3GT after our end of the summer hiatus. We do plan to start weekly recordings again, so we trust that you'll be able to continue to follow along. We'll look forward to Kyle again joining us again sometime in the future, but I think you'll find that the things that we have to offer will be of interest to you. If you're interested in learning more about 3GT, looking at past episodes, want to communicate with us, you can go over to our website at 3gt.xyz or write us at 3gt.xyz@gmail.com. I should say during this hiatus, we've gotten a few letters from listeners with some good topic ideas. So we're always thankful for that. So send those in to us as well. But for now, thank you again for listening to Three Guys Theologizing.